Hi, this is Julie Christensen with APSE. We're excited to launch the APSE Employment First, Employment for All podcast as a new way to connect with you. This podcast is a way to provide updates, real-time advocacy alerts, and information related to all things Employment First. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And thanks for listening.
Welcome to our discussion today. I'm Erica Bellis-Pacer, and I am the Professional Development Director at National APSE. And I'm just going to do a few housekeeping things, and then I'm going to hand it right over to Julie and Brian and John to do with their talk.
Thank you, Erica. Erica is our hostess with the mostest in our APSE world. She always does such a great job kicking off. And also want to give a shout out to the amazing Kari Tijin on our national APSE team who's joining us and providing some additional support. And I see board members. That's so exciting. There's like a couple of you. Anyway, I'm going to tone it down. So happy National Disability Employment Awareness Month, everyone. We were just commenting as we were chatting before today that, you know, there's so much going on in October, and but it is nice to be able to pause and to reflect. And that's kind of what we hope to do today. So I'm just going to give a quick little bit of context of today's conversation, what we hope to get out of it. And then we'll introduce our expert panelists who have some really interesting data points and perspectives to share. But as folks in the APSE community know, we started collecting some real-time data at the start of the COVID pandemic to get an idea of what was happening in real time as we found ourselves having to work from home and, you know, distance ourselves and wear PPE and do all of these things that changed the way that our day-to-day looks. And really the reason for doing that was to be able to have some sense of the pain, shall we say, being felt by people with disabilities in the workforce, by folks who are supporting them, our job coaches, our job developers, certainly our funding streams, our systems partners. You know, we all kind of came at this with different strains and points of pain as we worked together to try to figure out how to keep doing what we do in a different world. And I want to just give a tremendous round of thank you to Source America and to ICI at UMass Boston, who partnered, shall we say, gave their time and effort and brain power to looking at our COVID survey and adding some additional questions that helped us broaden our perspective and our point of view. And really, I think that to me is the spirit of National Disability Employment Awareness Month, is widening our lens from the place where we spend our day-to-day time, but thinking about the importance of a collaboration of looking at employment for people with disabilities being all people with disabilities. And that requires multiple lenses, multiple paths, multiple funding streams, you know, all those different things. And so I'm just really grateful for our partnership with our friends at Source America and ICI for helping us think this through. So with that in mind, we're going to dive in to some conversation and discussion. And we do invite you to post questions in the chat as we go. We'll be monitoring those and bringing that into the conversation. But let me start with introductions, because I did not introduce myself, which I am really bad at doing. So I'll start with myself. My name is Julie Christensen. My pronouns are she, her, hers, and quick visual description. I'm a closely approaching 50s white woman with brown hair and brown eyes, wearing some variety of blue and gray today, which seems to be my COVID color palette. And I serve as the executive director of National APSE and the director of policy and advocacy. And with that, Brian, would you please introduce yourself?
Yes, and Julie, thank you again for including Source America in this work. Thank you, John. We certainly came at this with, I think, shared concerns around the impact of COVID to both persons with disabilities and to our service networks, and we appreciate being able to be involved in this survey. My name is Brian DeAtley. I am a director and the Workforce Development Department at Source America. I've been with Source America approximately 20 years. Prior to Source America, I was a job coach and a, supervisor of employment services focused on CIE and supportive employment techniques for probably the previous 20 years. Early APSE member in the late 80s. I have a graduate degree in vocational rehabilitation from George Washington University. I am a past 60, slightly balding white guy wearing glasses and a plain shirt and a somewhat boring jacket.
John?
Okay. Hi, folks. John Butterworth. My pronouns are he, his, and I am a tall guy with pretty gray hair at this point and glasses and a button-down shirt, which probably Brian also qualifies as boring, like your jacket. But I'm thrilled to be here just because all of us have been trying to understand both the opportunities and challenges that we faced during COVID. And there's no one single source for putting all that information together. So having a chance to work some with APSE on their survey and put that together with some of our national data and the work of states that we work with has been really valuable. So I work at the Institute for Community Inclusion at UMass Boston, and part of my brain is in tracking national data and trends on employment services and outcomes. Part of it is working with states, and some of my thinking comes from the 24 states that are members of the State Employment Leadership Network and are struggling every day to try to figure out both how to expand employment and how to respond to a pandemic. And the other piece is our work directly with providers and individuals in trying to improve the quality of employment supports and understands people's employment experiences. So kind of trying to thread all those pieces together.
And again, thank you both for being here. I'm excited with a little prep conversation, and I wished it could have kept going because the ideas were just flowing in my brain of ways to work together and move forward. So I think I've said this a couple of times, multiple times, that, you know, I have zero desire to return to normal. Normal wasn't working. We were not moving the needle on employment for people with disabilities. And so I do think that the last 18 months, while they have been challenging and they've changed in many ways, probably for the long haul, some of the things that we do on a day-to-day basis, really, it's about how do we move forward and how do we really make employment for everyone a reality, not just in October, National Disability Employment Awareness Month, but really building on the Employment First movement as a year-round, everyday thing that we're all working towards. And so we have a couple of topics that we're going to kind of talk through. We'll hit on employment supports. So the actual how we do the work and how that has changed. We'll talk a little bit about employment outcomes for people with disabilities. So what's happening in the labor market. And I'm sure probably very close and dear to the hearts of everyone on today's webinar. What about the workforce, our direct support professionals, who we know were stressed pre-pandemic and have been essential workers and right out there on the front lines, continuing to do more with less. So kind of where do we go from there? We'll pepper in a couple of data slides because I don't know, I can't be on a webinar with John Butterworth without having a couple of data slides. I love that part of the work. So let me get going, but we'll start with the service closures. And just for a quick data point, we won't get into the details of the data, but what you're looking at, if you are able to see the slides on screen, is sort of a pre and post. So looking at summer of 2020 versus summer of 2021 and service closures for services that we are all collectively involved in. And so the green on the top would be a year ago, the blue would be kind of this moment in time. And so there's, you know, good news, bad news, as there always is. I think no one's surprised at the level of service closure at the start of the pandemic, but we've rebounded quite a bit with room still to go. We are not back to baseline in some respects, but again, the goal is not to return to baseline. It's to think about new ways of doing business, and that includes facility-based services versus services in the community. The other piece that really has happened and is an interesting data point for this piece of our conversation is to talk about how we deliver services. So obviously, tremendous increase in the use of remote virtual supports. Here we all are on a Zoom call, which has become our new normal for good or bad. But we also know job coaching and job development is happening remotely. And so what does that mean? Not just the tremendous growth in utilization during the pandemic, but I think this slide right here showing that, and it really hasn't changed much over the past year, virtual supports are here to stay. And so what do we do with that and what do we learn? So I'm going to unshare my screen and pitch it back to my colleagues and start, Brian, maybe with you in, you know, kind of what are the big takeaways from the last 18 months thinking about services within the Source America world?
Well, Julie, thank you. I would start by sort of, I think at Source America, some of our specific data mirror the survey result. I think almost, you know, verbatim. We had 413 NPAs, CRPs, I think, to the APSE folks. But we had 413 nonprofit agencies when COVID started producing and working in the Source America network. And we've lost 19 of those in the last 18 months. And most of those were due. And again, it's difficult to single out COVID. I mean, COVID and, if you will, larger economic macro trends and how those two relate is easy to, I think, put to COVID. And in most cases, I believe it to be true. But Source America operates under government contracting and certainly is our growth or not growth is sometimes determined by, if you will, other outside factors. From our network, we are certainly seeing requests for more information around how to deliver services virtually. Source America is working to deliver better services, especially better CIE services. And I think I'll have a chance to talk about that later on in the webinar. Certainly, we have been asked by our network to provide supports as it relates to to masks, to gloves, to information. I mean, to sort of, if you will, help channel federal regulations. I mean, we have to get people on Army bases, Navy bases, in federal buildings. And it's not hectic, but it's certainly been a very busy time across all of Source America.
And John, I know you stay very connected to the Medicaid world and the VR world for that matter, but I'm curious if you could kind of jump in here in terms of what you've seen in service delivery.
You know, I'm kind of intrigued on that first chart that you showed, Julie, or maybe disappointed that so many said that they wanted to restart facility-based services, because I think one of the interesting things we've seen, though it's a small number of organizations, is providers that have said, okay, this is the time to change. there's an organization that we spent time talking with based in Minnesota, MRCI, that shut down 7 facilities and laid off some 400 staff and then rehired people into a different model of supports. So we kind of had we had and still have this prime opportunity to really do the things that we say that we want to accomplish in terms of people being full members of the community, both as employees and in other kinds of ways. you know, the other piece I think that comes to mind at, for kind of this phase of our conversation is shifting the direct supports that we provide. And you talked about the virtual piece, and that's certainly a big part of it. But we've also had to rely a lot more on natural supports and have seen tremendous examples of people who had relied on on-site job coaching kinds of supports over an extended period of time. And suddenly, you know, their employment support person was not an essential personnel anymore and was not permitted in that workspace. And the fairly quick pivot to remote supports as a way to substitute for some of that. But then the realization that not even all of those were needed. And people were able to step up and be supported, be both effective on their own, but be supported more by their coworkers and other folks in the workplace. There was a lot of innovation in things like remote job shadowing and remote interviews, virtual job clubs, things that drew people together in a way that was really difficult to do before. The ability to keep people connected who are already working in the community, but still have a need for a point of connection and support with peers. Something families said very much as feedback was the enhanced peer-to-peer supports was a really important piece of what happened over the last year and a half. So there's a lot we learned about what effective support is. We can talk maybe a little later about some of the other feedback from individuals and families about kind of what they appreciated about this past year and a half and what the implications of those are for how we rethink services. And I think the challenge is how do we avoid going back to a presumption of 30 hours a week of something in a place and move to something that is truly individualized. We use that word a lot, but we don't implement it a lot. And helping people to build lives around their own goals.
Yeah, and you know, something you said, John, about a few moments ago about why the shift in we were going to keep our facilities closed, but now we're opening them, and that missed opportunity. We'll have a chance to talk a little bit later about funding streams, but you know, that's another piece of it. How much of it is falling back to not just what we're used to, but what funding mechanisms support, right? I mean, right. Innovation happens in a crisis and we're all kind of okay with it. And then it's like, crisis is over. So now we get back to our rigid, you know, ways of doing things. And how do we move that? The needle on that.
And ultimately there are two sides to that. There is, do we have funding system streams that support that kind of individualized outcome in an effective way and can do that flexibly and fluidly? And the second is just, as you said, falling back on what we know. I mean, the old, more center-based way of doing things is a predictable income stream that we all understand. And it's scary to step into something else, even if it's viable as a business plan.
Sure. Well, you set the stage well for kind of our next data point in thinking through what do outcomes look like now versus, a year ago. And, you know, I know these, John, are your slides. And so you might want to talk through them a little bit in greater detail, but it's really interesting to me to just look at the differences between folks who are in individual competitive integrated employment versus group supported employment and what's happened. But then overall, this is the piece that, you know, to me is so exciting and is playing out with the latest, the newest data from Department of Labor, that people with disabilities have surpassed people without disabilities in terms of returning to pre-pandemic levels of employment. That doesn't mean that we're not in an equitable place, but just in terms of rebounding. And so clearly things were continuing to work in some way, shape, or form. And so how much of that is innovation? how much of that is, you know, sort of crisis management, how much of it is we just, you know, became more efficient or, you know, better at what we did. I think all of those are in play. I think the other thing, Brian, is a recognition that for contract work, for thinking about the Ability One program in particular, so many of those contracts were deemed essential because they're, you know, part of Department of Defense. And so, you know, we can't talk about disability employment without recognizing the significant number of job opportunities that exist through the Ability One program. So I'll kind of pause there and maybe Brian, let you kind of talk a little bit from the Source America perspective, and then John would love to hear more of your thoughts about those data trends.
Well, at Source America, I guess from pre-COVID to post-COVID, we're down approximately 5,000 jobs off an approximately 40,000 job base. That number is starting to trend back up, but there's been jobs lost. Now, while it is true that some people, and I think it's certainly one of my questions for John, is that and I think that John sort of pointing to the fact that even though we track number of people with disabilities and we can look at cursory data and say that certainly people with the highest impact of disabilities might have been most impacted by COVID, both in terms of the pandemic, both in terms of being able to provide those people reasonable support, because I think we'll get to the, I don't know if it's a crisis, but the ability of many of our NPAs to recruit and train professionals, DSPs, is problematic. And again, that could be because of COVID. It could be because of larger trends and pay around entry level jobs in other communities. But the feeling certainly in our workforce development department is that the impact here has been on people with more significant disabilities needing greater support. And again, cursory data would also indicate that in our NPAs that operate, if you will, independent CIE, supported employment or customized employment opportunities, that impact is also being felt because there's not appropriate levels of staff to often meet those needs. And a lot of that is due to recruitment and issues around that. I had a longer conversation with John, with one of our NPAs in Boston this morning. And she said she just raised her entry level staff rates to $17.50 an hour. But her experts are telling her that that really needs to be $22 or $23 an hour to be competitive inside the greater Boston area.
Yeah.
Well, certainly workforce is something we'll come back to later. But, you know, when you're competing against $15 to $17 an hour, starting salary at grocery stores where I am right now is about $17 an hour. That's what's posted. So, you know, yes, we got a ways to go in terms of thinking about how we compensate and support people. You know, if you want to bring up those slides again, Julie, just for a second, maybe go to the middle one first. You know, part of what's interesting is this was an economic crisis. and employment participation dropped off for everybody really steeply in the first 2 months of COVID. But it dropped off, as it does in most economic crises, more for people with disabilities. This is from the Monthly Employment Situation Report. It's the report that gives us the unemployment numbers every month. That's the part that people talk about. That's actually not a very useful way to talk about employment and disability, but that's the numbers that they give us every month. But under that is some more detailed numbers. These trend lines, the 0% in February 2020 is the baseline, and it's the numbers, and it's, and then what you're looking at is change in the raw number of people who are working. So if we get back up to 0%, then we've got the same number of people working today as we had working in February 2020. So people with disabilities, the dotted blue line, dropped off steeper and took longer to recover. both dropped off pretty steeply during those couple of months. But the kind of weird and interesting thing and opportunity to some extent is starting in about May of 2021, the line rose up above the no disability line for people with disabilities. And we're at a point over the last several months now where there are more people with a disability working today, in a raw number, more people working today than there were pre-pandemic. That trend line for people without disabilities is still below the raw number that were working pre-pandemic. Now, there's a couple of things to say about that, and there are probably a bunch of reasons for that. One is fewer people were working to begin with, so things like unemployment insurance weren't really an option for people. There's a lot of demand out there in the workplace right now, and it's a good entry point for people. There are plenty of businesses in all sectors that are desperately looking for people. There's kind of the interesting stuff. There was something that came out just this week that in the last month, 3% of people left their jobs across the economy. That's the highest rate that I think has ever been seen. So people are leaving jobs for lots of reasons still and using this as a chance to make changes in their work lives. So there is an opportunity, and there are providers, maybe some of you guys who are on here, who tell us that they've done a booming business finding people jobs. We've also seen people who retain jobs work more hours, which is pretty interesting. And if you back up one slide, Julie, to the one before that. Yeah, that one. You know, the other part of this story is states differ a lot. And this is where state policy and practice and funding becomes a really important part of the picture. You know, clearly the folks that we support and who are supported by state systems, in this case, state IDD agencies, you know, got hit harder in this. So, you know, on average across the 7 state employment leadership network, state member states that implemented this survey with their provider community, you know, a little over half of people several months into the pandemic who had been working before the pandemic were not working. That's a huge hit. Folks in group supported jobs were less likely to work. Or put another way, folks in individual jobs, their life situation was more resilient than people in either group-supported jobs, certainly the facility-based jobs, and any kind of non-work services. They were more likely to have their life not change. But the other piece underneath this is state differences. So kind of at the bottom is the state where only about 33% of people retained their employment who were in individual jobs. And the top is, I think, somewhere between 65 and 70%. And that has to do with the extent to which a state system sustained funding through that period. It's in part the extent to which they prioritized health and safety over supporting people to make choices about how they spent their time and their lives. And there's kind of that interesting category over on the right of people voluntarily not working. And it's like, whose voluntariness are we talking about? Was that really an individual choice? And I'm sure it was for some people. Or was that an aging family member? And that's not a diss on the family member in any sense of the word. But, you know, if they're living with an aging family member who has major health problems, having a family member go out to work could be a real barrier. And then, you know, in a more systemic way, folks living in congregate living situations who were not permitted to leave the house to go out to work. And that was part of the pressure point we hit during the pandemic.
Yeah, and John, go ahead, Brian.
Oh, I was going to say, John, that certainly reflects, for example, Source America-related NPAs that also operate congregate setting, residential settings. And the pressures put on those settings. And in some cases, again, staff-related issues. That some of the homes weren't fully staffed to the degree they once were. And then some of the, I think the the pressure on some of those homes to keep people close.
Yep.
Sure. And you know, on the individual level, John, your comment about, you know, having aging relatives or whatever, that's not even a disability specific conversation, right? That's the entire workforce, whether you have
that's the entire workforce.
Yeah, whether you're with a disability or not. So I think it's an important point to highlight, because some of what we're looking at in some respects, I think for the first time in this way, is the normalization of life as it impacts people with and without disabilities in relation to, you know, their participation in the labor market. And so, you know, it can be really easy to jump to, oh, well, you know, people with disabilities decide not to work. Well, look at the general population. We're not recovering jobs lost in any category right now.
And we don't really have a good way to look at some of those impacts. Effectively, Caroline mentioned that the people who continued working were people who lived independently. Again, that comes back to resilience. Where you live really matters in terms of the flexibilities you have in your life, the choices you're able to make. You know, some of the safety concerns were real for all of us and throughout the workforce.
You both touched on the direct support professional workforce, and I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this slide because it frankly depresses me. but what you're looking at is sort of a pre and post self-report from the provider community, thinking through how many job coaches and job developers, specifically employment professionals, were furloughed or laid off due to the pandemic, and then comparing that number to the anticipation of being able to hire those folks back. And where that leaves us is with losing roughly 20% of our workforce. And we had a workforce crisis prior to the pandemic. So can we spend a little bit of time there? And Brian, I'm going to punt back to you, because you'd already kind of opened up the door for this conversation in, you know, what that looks like within the Source America universe.
Again, thanks, Julie. Not hard data, cursory information would point to both inside of our network, terrible issues with retaining, and then it's sort of, and then recruiting new people into the direct service profession, you know, to be job coaches, to be case managers, to support people with disabilities. And we try to, because we have a corresponding region, it varies region to region, but we have some corresponding issues with recruiting people with disabilities to do direct service work too.
Yeah.
On our contracts. And that those are primarily higher paid service jobs under the Service Contract Act, with, you know, a fairly decent set of benefits. And at Source America, we, you know, we've been trying to look at these issues together. We don't want to separate staff among our NPA, and we want to try to provide to the best degree possible information that will help, you know, address some of these issues. You know, we've got some PhDs from Mathematica that are helping us, for example, structure incentives and bonuses. We're looking at non-paid bonuses to retain people, greater sort of attention than maybe childcare issues, thinking about maybe repayment of student loans as an incentive. But the incentives, certainly paid incentives, can only take you so far, because, you know, for the most part, most of our NPAs are not, you know, looking to, or, you know, use big profits. And the fact of the matter is, if we could raise pay across the, I think if we could raise entry level pay across the field by 20 or 25%, all this stuff would probably at least go away, or would certainly be, you know, alleviated. But there is no doubt that both from the data that we've collected and from a ton of information that comes through my desk, is that I don't like to say crisis, But you can't serve people if you don't have people to provide services. And if you're losing people, you have this sort of tangential issue of needing to train new people. And if, for example, and at Source American through our community, there is a greater emphasis on how to do CIE and how to provide those sorts of unique skills, that's not a job that you can sort of, that translates easily for somebody without experience. And those aren't skill sets that can be tackled in a 2-day training. So we are challenged with trying to decide how to provide resources to both support NPAs in recruiting and retaining staff, while at the same time trying to up our game around creating real professionals that know supportive employment, that know customized employment, that understand person-centered services, that. Holy cow. I mean, we just started some work with Cornell to professionalize some of our benefits training. I mean, there's just no way that you could set loose somebody with a casual sort of, with some sort of casual skills around SSI and SSDI and have them help people make decisions around, you know, their work life. I mean, that's a, you know, it's a 4-month course. It's graduate level stuff. And a lot of people are going to fail out of it.
Right. Yeah, and I
hope that answered your question, Julie.
It does, and I'm gonna just emphasize a little bit for our APSE audience, some of whom might not be quite as familiar with Source America and the work that you guys are doing. But I've been just so incredibly impressed with the focus on competitive integrated employment, on looking at supported employment, investing in transformation. You know, these are things that Source America has really been promoting even pre-pandemic. But I think, you know, the over the last 18 months in particular, it's been such a great opportunity to kind of witness in real time the supports that you're providing for your MPA network.
Julie, there a lot of those are still in development. I can't claim that there. I mean, and we partner with Mark Gold and Associates for a lot of this. I'm not going to claim, you know, that Source America is a hotbed for expertise in CIE. We have a small staff. We've been allotted, you know, I think a considerable amount of resources, and we've tried to pick partners who will work with us and help us in these areas.
Yeah, absolutely understood. And if I misstated it.
No, it's fine. It's fine, Julie. And I would add that even though we've had a long-standing concern with some of these areas, some of this work has to do with external pressures and financial pressures and honestly, state pressures.
Correct. Yeah. And I think, you know, my point being that, you know, there is an emphasis to move in the same direction towards competitive integrated employment. And to your point, not everyone's an expert. I you know, I think it's what you just described is a great example of how I talk about APSE, that, you know, the APSE network, if you're on the journey to competitive integrated employment, then you're welcome to the table. Not everyone is 100% there yet, but part of the joy of working within this community is that there are so many pockets of excellence that we can draw from. And really, it's the ability to kind of look across state lines, across, you know, funding streams, to think about innovation in new ways. And so I think, you know, to that extent, John, I kind of want to pivot back. On the Medicaid side, I saw that Erica made the comment about mandates. And I know she's specifically talking about is the move with in the federal government to mandate vaccines and what that means in terms of Medicaid providers and so on and so forth. But, you know, those are those other external pressures that Brian was just talking about, you know, those other things that we can't control that often feel like they're controlling us. So curious, John, what you would add to this part of the conversation.
I mean, I think what I would add first is, you know, it's kind of clear to all of us that this shone a spotlight on the workforce crisis, but it's both of you guys implied or mentioned that this is not a new problem that we're facing. I think, you know, part of it is creating professional wage levels for people. I worry a little bit about the rush to use American Rescue Plan Act funds for things like hiring bonuses, because those are short-term fixes, not long-term fixes. You know, that might get someone in the door, just like it might get someone in the door at McDonald's, but it doesn't mean that someone's going to stick around. You know, ultimately, we have to stabilize people at good wage levels that reflect the work they're doing. You know, the other parts of being a professional, and particularly an employment support professional, one of the things that happened in a lot of states during the pandemic is people were viewed as utility workers. So the people who were doing employment supports or other day supports got shifted to residences because they needed to staff their residences and their day programs were closed. A lot of those people aren't moving back or aren't available anymore or lost skills in that process. And I think that sense of kind of interchangeability that a direct support professional is a direct support professional works against as a field, that's an attitudinal barrier at an organizational level. And some states did a better job of sustaining that. Kind of an easy example, I kind of almost hesitate because it's too easy an example. One of the ways that Washington State sustained funding during the pandemic is they made engaging in training a billable activity. So employment support professionals who went to training on employment, that was a billable activity during the pandemic for them, and it allowed them to keep time. I mean, they were also still supporting people. They made, you know, they had some drop off in employment, but did a pretty good job of keeping people employed. But their time that they weren't available to support people, they had other ways that were professional development oriented to kind of sustain their work in the field. And Washington chose to look at that as a development opportunity. That's a really different perspective. And it's a stake in the ground about the role that people play and the professionalism. Certainly, you know, we have to deal with a lot of issues. The CESP certificate, ACRE certification, bringing those as they're beginning to come more and more into waivers is an expectation of provider qualification is an important part of this. That puts some pressure on things like wages. There's an initiative in the direct support professional movement now. The folks at University of Minnesota are very much part of this to create occupational categories that capture this group of professionals. I think from an APSE perspective, making sure there's some differentiation between direct support professionals who do kind of residential and general care support work and people who are doing the kind of work that your average employment consultant does. You know, they're very different job roles. Both require a lot more than they get given credit for, but they're different. And as that movement moves forward, and what those folks say is to get something into the dictionary of occupational titles is like an 8 to 10 year process. This is a long haul investment, but it's something that is moving now that we need to pay attention to.
Absolutely. So I'm doing a time check and want to shift our conversation. We've spent a little bit of time talking about the shifts over the last 18 months, but now I kind of want to move us forward. And I'm going to use John's language from a presentation that he did recently and focus the last couple minutes we have together on imagining the future. Where do we go from here? And so, John, I'm going to kick this off with you because I know through SELN, you have some great perspectives from family members, from individuals with disabilities about, you know, what the future should be.
So a lot of states have done outreach to families and individuals about what they want next and what reentry, whatever that means to them. Part of what I'm struck is that people are not universally saying they want to go back to where it was before. They are saying they want something different. I think specifically about some survey work that ICI was involved in Massachusetts. And, you know, there was a contingent, this was a survey of families, so it's a family perspective, just to be clear. But, you know, there was a contingent of families that said, We want the program to reopen. We want our sons and daughters to go back. There are families that really rely on that for their own employment and other parts of their lives. But there was at least an equally strong voice of families that said, we want to retain the flexibility. We want more time in the community for our sons or daughters. We want more employment for our sons and daughters. It was a really strong voice in the response to that survey. Individuals and families are saying, we don't want it to go back to where it was. We like some of the parts of virtual services, and we'd like some opportunities to do some of our stuff from home. And then we'd like the rest of the time to be more focused on getting us out into employment or other kinds of community activities that are meaningful to us. We want the flexibility of not getting up at 6 a.m. to get on the van. I'd like my day to start at 11 because that really works better for my brain. I think those things, you know, kind of the general thought that getting back to a large day program wasn't really a high priority for people is an important part of what we need to think about going forward. Tremendous support for increased access to technology and the impact on people's lives. Individuals found that it helped them connect with friends more readily on their own terms, on their own schedules, not just by going to a place, a program place. Families talked about the power of peer-to-peer interaction and supports and what that meant for their family members. The skill development that the use of technology led to for people was tremendous. So, you know, we have a waiver challenge of how do we make the resources for those things, the technology itself, and notice I'm not saying assistive technology here, the technology itself, but also the support in using that technology, access to things like support for internet access to make it possible to use those technologies. Those are things we haven't routinely provided as part of the supports that we provide to people. Other stuff I think about, the flexibility piece, activities, the settings people spend that time in, the way they get supports is a big part of it. Continuing to use remote strategies for helping people to connect to the full range of employment settings that are possible. So using things like virtual job exploration, remote interviews and things like that as a way to expand people's contact with what's possible are important pieces of what needs to change. I think as I think about the combination of the workforce crisis and our funding crisis and those other pieces, if people get 15 hours a week of well-funded, interesting supports and let them do what they want, or even 10 or 12 hours a week, as opposed to 30 hours a week of poorly funded congregate activity, I think there's space in there to both work on the workforce crisis and provide people with more interesting work to do, more professional work to do, and better wage levels for the work they do, and to do what people are asking for in terms of this higher level of individualized, flexible set of opportunities to engage with our community. There's room for those to meet in the middle, but that's radical change. That's really rethinking the structure of our service definitions and our rate structures and simple things like our expectations, you know, like getting away from the knee-jerk reaction that if a person works 3 hours in the morning, then we have to give them something to do in the afternoon. Well, you know, some people maybe want or need something to do in the afternoon, but a lot of people would rather go home or you know, figure out something else.
Yeah. And, you know, we started off with our context conversation about not returning to normal. So, you know, as you're talking, I'm imagining as I'm kind of looking at all the participants that, you know, some things feel uncomfortable, but that's what innovation is, right? It's taking risks in new directions and, you know, figuring out what works. And so, Brian, anything you would add to the list of things, you know, we should be thinking about?
I would, I guess, target my comments towards Source America, because that's the pool that I swim in. We are doing a much better job of both listening to our workers and listening to disability advocates. You see it at Source America, the current, if you will, pressures to reduce the government required ratios on contracts, which certainly will provide our MPAs a great deal more flexibility in providing CIE services and options to people with disabilities. We certainly need to do and are doing a lot more of peer-to-peer, listening to our workers, putting them together and having them, if you will, exposed to other voices in the disability community. As a whole, in our workforce development department, one of our overall goals is to be more strategic and partner with more external disability organizations. We certainly want to be involved. John mentioned remote strategies. Certainly, we believe in them, not to the exclusion of on-site technical help and on-site training. I don't know if I could plug virtual job share here as a platform that we're using in coordination with Discovery. We bought a bunch of seats, and I think they filled in a week and a half. So there is, and certainly we are dramatically expanding both certification and anchor opportunities through our virtual learning systems. And again, partnering with Mark Golden Associates to include more webinars. And generally speaking, you know, people know, I mean, we're eliminating the use of 14C certificates across our contracts. And it's a time of challenges and change at Source America. And certainly in terms of partnering with and listening to other voices in the disability field, there's changes at the Ability One Commission. I mentioned changes possible to our ratios. There is a lot going on, and certainly our jobs at Source America remain to raise wages, and certainly increase opportunities and choices for people inside of our network.
Yes, thank you for that. And I'll just add, you know, a couple of cautionary layers to this conversation. First, by saying whenever someone uses the term radical, it makes me excited because I'm just a girl from Berkeley, California. So thanks for throwing that out there, John. But, you know, as we move forward and we think about innovation, it's also going to be so critical to ground innovation in outcomes. Which is why we touched on both. And so, you know, a couple of things that I ponder and I think, you know, the APSI network needs to continue to look at and continue to brainstorm about. So, you know, hearing that individuals and families are saying we really like, you know, remote supports, which tracks with, you know, my experience out in the field and people saying, why do I have to have a job coach standing right next to me? You know, that makes me different than everybody else. But there's a tension there, right? The more that we use technology at the same time that we have less people, fewer job coaches and job developers in the market could potentially put us in a situation of going down a path of over-reliance on virtual and remote supports. And so we do need to keep an eye on quality and outcomes. Where does technology help us and is a tool for good versus making sure that we continue to advocate for and partner with our various funders to make sure that that face-to-face can continue to happen when it's needed. And how do we make those decisions? The other piece that, you know, that I hear a lot, and it interestingly hasn't come up today, but we've for a long time talked about working from home as a reasonable accommodation for people with disabilities, which in today's environment on October 14th of 2021, you know, probably most of us are working from home as we're watching this webinar. And so, you know, to some extent, you know, from an advocate perspective, I can say, yes, we're finally there. We recognize that, you know, people can contribute working from home. And that opens up so many doors for people with disabilities who have various barriers to entry into the workforce. The cautionary tale to that, though, is that what we don't want is work from home to move beyond reasonable accommodation to becoming the new form of seclusion. That it's easier for a business to say, sure, I will hire you, person with a disability, but you have to work from home, because that's a heck of a lot easier than me doing the work to make the work environment accommodating and able to meet your needs. So just a couple of thought starters, you know, for our continued conversation. I know we're running up on time, but I just, John and Brian, I want to thank both of you for your ongoing commitment to the work, for your ongoing partnership. And I'm really excited, honestly, about the year ahead and seeing kind of where we go from here. So hopefully maybe a year from now, we can all come back and talk about, you know, the new lessons learned. But anything either of you want to say in closing?
Now, I'll just echo what you said about looking forward to how we play out some of the opportunities that got handed to us in the midst of the challenges.
Yeah.
And echo your concerns, Julie, is that technology, I believe, can take us a long way and help solve some of our problems. But at the same time, relying on virtual tools and virtual trainings exclusively, I believe, would in many cases lose some of the person-centered principles that I think APSE has championed all these 30 years.
Yeah, very much.
Again, thank you both. And thank you everyone who attended today. Thank you to Erica and Kari from the national team for doing all the magic that makes this happen. And happy National Disability Employment Awareness Month to you all. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.